is rarely met with, even in 100,000 million kalpas, having it to see and listen to remember and accept. I vow to taste the truth of the Tathagata's words.
Morning. I want to talk about Mel. I tried to think about it yesterday, and I thought I should write down some notes, but I couldn't do it. It was like a I don't know, not even a raw spot, just. So I thought, I'll just talk. I think I sent you a link to a Lion's Roar article, and it had the sort of the dates of his life and all that sort of thing. So I want to talk about the Sojourn that I knew. I started at the Berkeley Zen Center in March of 1988. And I used to go to the early morning, and you could leave after 40 minutes or sit through for an hour and stay for service. And I needed to walk the dog and get to work. And so I left after 40 minutes. And I would go on Saturdays, but not to the early morning part. I think that's 9:30 zazen and lecture. So it took a while before I actually knew him. I saw him, I first spoke to him at Green Gulch, where I used to go on Sundays, and he had given the lecture, and he was out on the deck where they served tea and muffins. And so I went and introduced myself, and he said he recognized my sweater because, of course, he just saw my back. And I wore the same green cotton knit sweater. He told me that Suzuki Roshi had noticed, I don't know what he had something when he started sitting in San Francisco at the old Zendo on Pine. And he wore the same thing. And that one time Suzuki Roshi kind of fingered his shirt or something and said, "This is your robe." And so he said that this green sweater was my robe, which is true. And that's the first time we met. And I kept going to Berkeley. I had started with a weekend workshop with Yvonne Rand, and so I was doing Doksan kind of thing with her for a while. But eventually I decided that I should talk to him. I think I was, I already had a relationship with Maylee Scott, who was leading at Berkeley, like a Wednesday night group. But I figured I should have some relationship with the abbot. I mean, I don't know that I even thought about it that way then. But I signed up to go see him and started talking with him. And it was an intense time because by the time I started doing Doksan with him towards the end of 88, my mother was already actively dying of cancer. So that was what we talked about a lot. And he gave me the koan of, he gave me the koan of K-55 of the Blue Cliff Record, Alive or Dead. So I worked with that. And our relationship was sort of mixed. I started to say rocky. I don't know that I'd say rocky, really. Maybe. Anyway, he offended me sometimes, and then I would go back and say, "You did this wrong, or you said this, and that wasn't right." And we would sort of argue about it. And then I would go see him again, and sometimes it was smooth and sometimes it wasn't. And when it wasn't, then I'd sign up to see him again really fast. And finally, he said to me, sometimes teachers send students away to work something through and then come back. I'm not ready to do that. And there was this huge yet hanging there. So luckily I had a really great analyst who didn't kind of take sides. You know, way too often I hear people say, "Well, my counselor, my therapist said I should be really mad at you." And I think, why are they putting themselves in the middle? So she certainly never said that. And instead we turned towards my father issues and my authority issues and my male authority issues. And I worked through a lot of stuff. A lot. And took back a lot of my projections on Jane. And learned how to confront him. That's one of the major things he taught me. Not on purpose, I think, but he did. To learn to say, "When you said X, I felt hurt. Period." And when I did it simply and directly and quickly after whatever the exchange was, he could meet me. But when I tried to argue with him and tell him, explain to him how he was wrong, which we do, it didn't work. And we talked. I said the other night at a sangha gathering at the Berkeley Zen Center Zoom event. That he, my experience of him, and something that really inspires me, is that he was really patient. And he was impatient about little things and kind of cranky. I'm a chip off the old block. And if he was your passenger in your car, he was always telling you to change lanes and get in that one is faster. And or why did you get in the right lane so early? You know, the off ramp is half a mile ahead. That kind of thing. But about the big things he was very patient. He did not push me about being ordained, and I went through a lot about that. And even, you know, every so often, I mean, it occurred to me after that weekend workshop with Yvonne Rand where I started, and I just sort of pushed it away. I mean, for God's sake, I was just beginning, and I looked like somebody who might be ordained. And it would come up for me, but I had a lot of issues about commitment. And it was a big deal to me. It is a doesn't feel to me. It is a deep vow level commitment. And, you know, I hesitated for a lot of reasons, some good and some not so great. And so it would come up sometimes, though, and I'd have it feel like I'd be talking to him about something. And inside me would be this priest, 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 priest. And so I had to say it just so I could let it go. You understand? I just had to say something so I could let it go. And I'd say, you know, it's coming up and I need to say it that it is. And he'd say, do you want to talk about it? And I'd say, no. And he just changed the subject. You know, he didn't push me about it at all. He didn't say, well, why are you obsessing about this thing unless you do want to do it? Or what's underneath that? Nothing. And this went on for, I don't know, I started saying years. I don't know if it was, but at least a year. And then I learned later that my friend Tia had asked him about, at one point she had said, she told him later, she said to him, why don't you ordain Mary? And he told her, I'm waiting on her. You know, but I never had that feeling. You know, there was never a feeling from him that he was anxious about it, or that he had ideas about it. And then when I finally got it together to ask him, you know, then we started talking about it and working with it. And he gave me koans and questions and stuff to drive it deeper. And the other example is I nagged him for years about giving the senior students more authority and, you know, in encouraging them to act like teachers so that they would be trained. Because the only way you learn how to give lectures, for example, is to give lectures. And he was reluctant about that. And I was particularly concerned that he give Alan Sanaki, Hozan, more authority, and that he should let him, you know, lead a practice period, for example. And I remember talking to him at one point about it, and he said that he was waiting for the Sangha to come to trust Alan in that way. I mean, Alan was already giving lectures and offering what I guess they'd call practice discussion. But he wasn't at that point, you know, vice abbot that came much later and so on. And but what Sojin said to me was that he was waiting for the Sangha to come to accept or to see Alan in that role, because it had to come from them. If it just was something that Mel just announced, you know, like, he's my successor and he's the next abbot, just shut up, you know, that wouldn't have worked. And I stepped back some, and I realized that made a lot of sense. And I still thought he was slow about it. And we continued over the years to talk about it. But I just, you know, I hadn't really considered it from that angle. And in fact, it has happened. You know, for the last few years, people at Berkeley Zen Center talk, you know, would refer to our teachers, and they meant Sojin and Hozan, Alan. He's trying to use Hozan now, so I'm trying to respect that. At any rate, those are two examples of his great patience, Sojin's great patience. And I saw it with other people and so on, but that's a great lesson to me. And I think it was his care of the Sangha. He was patient with me. He also pushed me. He used to say sometimes, he'd say, if I feel like you need a cookie, I'll give you a cookie. If I feel like you need, I don't remember what he said the other week. He didn't say kick in the butt. You know, and he rarely gave me cookies, which I take as a compliment. And he pushed me hard. He gave me koans. As I say, he gave me case 55 from the Blue Cliff Record, alive or dead. And other koans. And he gave me koans when we were driving the priest vow question deeper. And he was at Tassajara, especially, you know, he led practice periods when I was there. He led my first one. It was very sweet. And he taught the Heart Sutra. And that's very much on my mind as we're going to study the Heart Sutra this spring, I believe. And one of the concepts that we worked with was, I think it's discussed in a wonderful essay about the Heart Sutra by Abbot O'Wara. It's one of the long theses in a book called The Tiger's Cave. And he writes about the Heart Sutra and this concept of having an empty heart. A heart that's not holding on to me, mine, and so on. Now, as opposed to an ego heart. Anyway, there were two sesshins usually in a practice period, and it was a very small one. It was really tightly, you know, it was hard to staff it, I think, for them. At any rate, I decided that I would volunteer to work one of them in the kitchen because I'd already sat two sessions, maybe three, before I started Tassajara that year in September. And I would sit the longer one. So I thought, well, I could volunteer for the short one. And I thought it would be a session in the kitchen, which it was not so much. It was a lot of talking and so on. But at any rate, I did that. And the assistant, Tenzo, led the kitchen. And I snapped at her one day. When I eventually did apologize, she didn't even know what I was talking about. So I don't think it was a horrible thing. But my experience was I was kind of short with her. And so I felt bad, and I really had to struggle with myself to get to the point of being able to just apologize, to just say, I'm sorry, I was rude to you, without, but you know, excuse me, no, go on, get back, good dog. To say, I'm sorry, I was rude to you, without telling her how she was wrong, or how I was upset with the fact that the kitchen was so lax, or, you know, whatever. I'm sorry. So it came time at the end of the session for the shosan, for the Dharma question and answer. And I said, I didn't, I, you know, I tried, I made it so it wasn't clear, but I said something about that I had been sharp with somebody and I had really struggled to find an empty heart to apologize, and that it felt like it cost a lot to get there. And I think I said, does it ever get easier? And he said, don't be stingy. I like that. And it's the kind of thing that just stays, you know, it stays with you. No. You can't. There's a dog head. Come. She's not walking. She's not putting foot in the zendo, but she's leaning into the zendo. When my father died, my mother died in January of 89, and my dad died in May of 89. And he had had multiple sclerosis for a long, long time, and he was pretty disabled. He could get up into a wheelchair until the very end. I mean, he could be assisted up to a wheelchair. And my mother had been demented, and she was an alcoholic. And it had been, you know, it was a really long, long haul. And I don't remember that I talked to him about it so much. I'm sure I did. It was what I remember is talking to him about death and dying. But at any rate, I went to LA and after when the caregiver called to say that my dad had died, and I flew down there and I washed his body and I stayed for a couple of days. And I came back and I went to Berkeley and we dedicated morning service to him. And at Berkeley Zen Center, right after the morning program is over on weekdays, there's about 5 minutes of soju, maybe a little longer, and the paths all get swept and the zendo kind of straightened up. And it's all silent. Anyway, but once that ended, I went to him and he took me in his arms and he whispered in my ear and he said, at last. And from him, I could hear that. I mean, you have to really know somebody to say that to them and not be offensive. And I'll tell you one more story. I didn't get the clock. Okay. When I was, you know, working with the koan, alive or dead, and being with my own fear of death, and the stew of feelings I had about my parents' death, I had sometimes sort of, you know, I'd call them visions, but they're not something that it's like I saw them in my mind's eye. And one was, I was sitting in the zendo and death came in looking like the third ghost in my version of Christmas Carol, you know, black robe and bony hand. And death came and got me out of the zendo and took me onto the zendo porch and pointed. And I looked out onto there's a lawn there. And these shadowy adult figures were just falling and melting into the ground. And then as the shadow body disappeared, a little Chinese poster baby would spring up in its place. You know what I'm talking about? Real round faces and happy apple cheeks. And I said to Death, then why do we cry? And Death said, because it's important. And when I told him about it, I told him that. And Death said, because it's important. And Sojin said, what did Death mean? And I hadn't thought about it. I didn't even, you know, I sort of a little bit wondered about it. I sort of a little bit understood. But I've always been struck by that, you know, that of course it's all me, it's all you. You know, in a dream, you're all the participants, including the monsters or whatever. And so I was Death. And I've been chewing on that ever since. What did death mean? And taking it, and you know, there's different levels. I mean, because as a teacher, it's important for me to remember to ask those questions. And to listen and not get caught up with answering them myself. And also, what does that mean? What does that mean if there's rebirth going on all the time, what's the big deal? And it is a big deal. How come? I don't know. I mean, I do know. We all know. Excuse me. Get back. Go on, get back. Go on. Rosie, back. Back. Go on, get back. Good dog. I'm sorry, you know, if you laugh, it's not useful. It's hard not to laugh when a dog sticks her nose. She's doing pretty well. Anyway, it's just, I think it was last week I was lecturing about, you know, the one who's not busy, and that there's this sort of individual one who's not busy, and there's the empty one that's capital O, that's of course not busy. And there's nothing but birth and death, and birth and death go on unceasingly. And what a joy to see those little babies. And it matters, it's important. And that's why, and we do cry. Maybe that's the great mystery, the great matter that the Han tells us we need to resolve. Dogen says you need to resolve the great matter. Oh, that reminds me. Here's another one, Kelly. I had forgotten that I gave you some homework. Anyway, years ago, Sojin and I talked about death a lot. He told me, he said at one point that I knew a lot about it, which is true. At any rate, I did a weekend workshop with Yvonne and Norman, and they gave us homework, and they said, okay, tonight, it was a two-day thing, so the first night, they said, when you go to sleep, imagine your death, and then when you wake up, imagine your birth. And so I went home, and I went to bed, and I imagined my death, and fear did not arise. And I thought, wow, I'm over my fear of death. Your kids say it without laughing. Anyway, I'm over my fear of death. And so the workshop went on. But so the next time I saw Mel for Doksan, I said, I told him about this, and I said, I think I'm over my fear of death. And he looked at me and he said, have you written your will? And I said, no. He said, write your will. And I didn't. And I had an appointment to see him maybe a month later in the afternoon at Berkeley, and was waiting my turn. And I realized, oh, I haven't written my will. So being a lawyer, I had a legal pad handy, and I started writing, and this great fear came up. You know, as soon as I started thinking about it concretely, because, you know, you start, okay, who's your executor? You know, so-and-so. Oh, so-and-so is older than I am. Maybe that, you know, I should have a fallback, or maybe somebody else. And then that person might get run over by a truck or whatever, you know, and it all of a sudden becomes very real. But what was really interesting was the fear that arose. And I seem to recall having asked Mr. McCubbin to write his will.
You did, and I haven't done it.
Well, let's make an appointment, and then you'll have a dead one.
Okay. All right.
Anyhow, I just thought that was, but I mean, in retrospect, that was very, it was so skillful. And of course, he'd been teaching for a long time, and he knew me. And of course, and now I understand, it doesn't go away. It sort of comes and goes, and it's up and it's not up. And it, my relationship with it has changed, but, you know, it just doesn't go away. I'm so sorry. Anyway, that's, and then in these last years, he seems to me to have gotten softer. And the more so since the diagnosis. I think it's been a little over a year since his diagnosis of the terminal cancer. Anyway, and he looked, I have a picture. I was one of four people, I think five people that sat with him. We sat with him for, I don't know, they were there before I was, because I rang the bell. I didn't realize how long it was going to take me to ring the bell, but I'm glad I did it. Anyway, he died at 5:30, and I think that people convened around 7:30 or something, because they had to wash his body and put his robes on and all. And Sarah Tashker from Green Gulch came and brought fresh herbs and flower petals. And he was ringed by them in the bed. I have a picture, and I'll send it to you, but... he looks like he's smiling. Is there a big reflection on it when you're looking at it?
Yes.
Here.
That's better.
Oh, yeah.
Isn't that something? He looks like a Virgin of Guadalupe or something, you know? Anyway, he did have this little smile on his face. It was very sweet to sit with him. And you know, we sort of alternated between kind of sitting zazen and just chatting. And his wife, Liz, came and sat with us some of the time, and we talked. And I asked her, if it were true that, you know, the story is that she saw him across the Tassajara Creek sitting on a rock playing the recorder, and was quite taken with him. And she said, yes, that had happened. And she told us about getting together with him, which didn't happen right away. She was down there with her boyfriend, but she was just totally smitten with Mel. And she said, you know, he was very intense, and you may very well have seen pictures of him. You wouldn't necessarily recognize him except for the big eyebrows. Maybe he was quite slender. And she said he was a chick magnet. This was, you know, around 1970. And then she met him again at the Berkeley Zen Center. He came up for a couple of days and she said, yeah, she, here she was like in great attraction to him. And the first thing she said to him was, "What are you doing here?" A great opening line. And he said, "I live here." And of course, she hadn't known that because he had been mostly at Tassajara that particular practice period for the summer or whatever. And she had been sitting there for a while. And then he went back to Tassajara, and then he returned to stay there at the Berkeley Zen Center on Dwight Way. And that's what I guess that they got to know each other better then. So it was very sweet to sit with Alan was there and Jerry Oliva, who is on our board of directors, and Andrea Thatch and a woman named Kika. I feel like I'm leaving somebody out, but maybe not. Jerry and Alan and me. I think that was it as of the Zennies. And then Liz and Mel's cousin and his wife. Anyway, it was really nice. And then at 11, the people from Pacific Internment came. Because Mel, you always have to talk with the family. And anyway, Mel was not so much into the notion of sitting with the body for 3 days. So that's enough for now. Does anybody have any questions or comments or anything? Kate?
Yeah, I just wanted to say I'm very sorry for your loss. It's a big deal to lose your teacher. Yeah. And I just wanted to note you to know that I'm feeling that. And I am a little curious about what's next. Will, you know, he'll be cremated and will there be a ceremony or is, you know, the COVID thing interfering with all that? I mean.
Yes, it is. And yes, there will be. And the place, Pacific Interment, which is where we usually use, they're set up with a video arrangement and so on, and they will only allow a couple of people in there. So I think it'll probably, you know, might be like Liz and Alan or something like that. I don't know exactly. And it will be probably next week sometime, but I don't know, everything is just more complicated right now. And people were sitting at the Berkeley Zen Center Zoom site all afternoon on and into the evening on Thursday, and people organized that were not at the house sitting with him. And then last night there was a sitting in the afternoon, I guess, and then at 7, from 7 to 9, there was, you know, this kind of a gathering and people were invited to speak. And today there's a one-day sitting, and the service this morning was dedicated to him, but it wasn't like a full-blown funeral, I'm sure. People maybe have been invited to speak, or maybe I'm sure that the lecture will be, or has been, was about him, and I'm sure it'll be posted. Anyway, there will be a big memorial, but that is sort of in process. And I know the Deshi, the disciples, are not in charge of that. I mean, we should be and will be, and are, and Alan is, you know, involved in the planning, but somebody else is in charge of it and would be the officiant and so on, because we are the mourners. And I was thinking about that this morning, that it's, you know, all I want to do is curl up on a little ball. So Akiva Roshi, the bishop around here for Soto Zen, was an old friend of Sojin's and of Western Zen. It's really wonderful to have him be the link with Soto school in Japan. And Reb, I think. And Linda Ruth Cutts from Green Gulch. Those people are involved in planning it. And it'll, I presume, be at City Center. And whether it'll be before we can all gather, I don't know. I mean, because obviously there, you know, you don't want to wait a year and a half, but anyway, it's usually, you know, a month or so, maybe 6 weeks after the person dies. It's not immediate. But at any rate, the cremation ceremony will be, I guess, broadcast on Zoom or whatever. I don't know that Berkeley has a YouTube channel, whatever, but it'll be available and I will let you know. And I don't know how they'll do it. I mean, I know what it usually involves. And the funny thing, which Alan remembered, that because the first, we did this with him for Maylee Scott, whom he treated as the abbess, though she never had a formal ceremony, but she really was the abbess of the Arcata Zen Center. And so we were there helping him. And he and I got into an argument, I'll say, true. Blanche taught me that at a cremation ceremony, you don't have a Buddha on the altar because the body is the Buddha. And so you put the altar at the foot of the coffin, you know, as if you could just take the body and stand it up, right? And so that the kind of small table altar should be at the foot, and he wanted it on the side. And I, being a good disciple of Blanche the form queen, you know, I just was appalled. I mean, I didn't scream at him or anything, but anyway, so I reminded Alan of that, because he had when we were sitting with Sojin, Alan had the little altar table with a candle on it and whatever. He had it actually at his head, but, you know, in line with the body rather than beside it. And he started laughing. He remembered. And I said, you better, you know, for the cremation ceremony, you better put it beside him. And he said he would. Anyway, you chant the Enmei Juku Kanagyo and you circumambulate the coffin. And each time you pass the little altar, you take I mean, ordinarily you take some chip incense and scatter it inside the coffin as you go around, and you just keep doing that. And as you chant, seven times, I think. And then you chant the Daishin Dharani. And you might chant the Buddhas and ancestors, if I remember right. And depends, you know, like for Blanche, it was full, and it was by invitation because there, you know, otherwise we would have totally overwhelmed the place. And so people were invited to speak. So that happens sometimes. And then you tell them when you're ready, and they, at Pacific Interment, they open the door to where the, what do they call them, retorts are. And it's really, they're already on. Some places not, but they're on, and you can hear it. It's a roaring sound. And then when they open the door, it gets louder, and then the body is on a, what do you got, like a lift, you know, the kind of thing that's like a metal, you know, goes crisscross, and you can raise it and lower it. So then they wheel it in and position it in front of the oven, the retort door. And the officiant goes, and you're chanting, I think the Heart Sutra as they go, and then they're there, and the officiant says some short thing, and then maybe shouts go. And nowadays the family or whoever is invited to push a button to start the process, and they do, or the people from the crematorium do it, and the body gets rolled in. But you don't see like huge flames leaping out, which was my fantasy the first time. That is very powerful. And then ordinarily you go back out into the sort of sanctuary place, and what I like to do is get in a circle and chant the refuges and sort of bow to each other to close the container. And then that's it. And people sort of filter out and often go somewhere and have lunch or a cup of tea or, you know, something, so that people can sort of decompress a bit. So I don't know what it's going to look like, Kate. I don't know.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Anybody else?
St. Mary, can you show us the card on the altar?
Yeah, would you mind if I bring the card to you? Or do you want to see the altar? It's got, you've seen this, I think. Well, it's got that wonderful drawing that Kate did. Let's see. Hard to get closer. How is that?
Okay. Is that close? That's good. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. How cool. Let's so hear means a million times, but I can't remember. Probably in that article. Because it also has the article that quotes the, it's not really an obituary, it's a notice that Alan sent. Okay.
beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to become it.
Three times, go ahead. Don't
beings
stop.
Are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them.